On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 25 years ago, 1981, the CDC reported its first cases of AIDS. It was a mystery killer. It looked like pneumonia. It looked like skin cancer. It looked like the problem of a few gay men. A quarter century on, at 25, AIDS is a huge global epidemic, the fourth biggest killer on the planet. In between came panic and sexual fear, condom distribution and needle exchanges, Ronald Reagan and Magic Johnson and Tom Hanks talking about things we had never talked about publicly before. Today, more than a million Americans are HIV positive. More women, more blacks, more heterosexuals. And globally, especially in Africa, it's a forest fire. But there's hope, too. Up next on Point, the plague of AIDS at 25. Joining me first today from Atlanta is Dr. Helene Gayle, one of the country's top AIDS experts and former director of the HIV campaign at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In 1984, she began working at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where she would serve for nearly two decades and direct the CDC's National Center for HIV, STD, and TB Prevention. She's now president and CEO of CARE, the International Humanitarian Group. Helene Gayle, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks. My pleasure.
Give us a sense first, as we talk today, 25 years later, of the face of AIDS today and how it has changed over that quarter century.
Well, I think, first of all, we're much more aware of the global nature of the epidemic. When HIV first began, a lot of the focus was on U.S. and Western Europe, and I think we've recognized since then that this is truly a global epidemic, and the impact is having its greatest effect in countries least able to mount an effective response, so countries living in poverty. Sub-Saharan Africa now accounts for almost 60-70% of the total number of new HIV infections. I think so clearly the global nature of this disease is much more apparent now than ever before. At the same time, the face of AIDS is increasingly the face of women. Almost 50% of new HIV infections globally are occurring among women. And in sub-Saharan Africa, about 60% of new HIV infections are occurring among women. Here in the United States, I think we tend to think, because we have a much greater ability to treat people with HIV, that the mortality rates have declined, we're much more likely to think that HIV is no longer a problem here. But in this country, we still have tens of thousands of new HIV infections occurring, roughly 40,000 new HIV infections occurring. Women are increasingly impacted by HIV here in the United States as well, making up about a third of new HIV infections. And people of color, particularly African Americans and Hispanics, are disproportionately impacted in the United States. So 50% of new HIV infections among African Americans, who only make up about 12.5% of our population, and Hispanics making up about 18%, Hispanics making up about 13% of our population. So both Hispanics and African-Americans disproportionately impacted. So I think, in short, it's clear that those who often have the least ability to respond to this epidemic are disproportionately impacted by this epidemic. It's very intertwined with other social issues that are at the root of the spread of HIV, both in this country as well as around the world. And increasingly, women are being hard hit by this epidemic, and women often have the least ability to influence their risk of HIV.
HIV AIDS-related deaths in the United States down almost 70% since 1995. That looks like tremendous progress, and yet that's down among just a small fraction, as you say, of the total AIDS victims globally.
Right. And, you know, I think that we should really be quite happy about the successes that we've had in treating people here in HIV. It's made a tremendous impact on the lives of people who are HIV infected in this country. At the same time, I think it means that we have an even greater responsibility to make sure that those same life-saving treatments, life-saving responses are able to be extended to people around the world. At the same time, while I think we have focused a tremendous amount here in this country on treating people who are already infected, we should, it's the right thing to do, we can make a big difference in people's lives, we've let our guard down around prevention issues here and I think increasingly around the world. Obviously, the greatest and most effective way of stemming the tide of HIV and AIDS is to reduce the number of people who get infected to begin with. We have approximately 5 million new HIV infections occurring every year. About a million people, a little bit more now, have gotten access to treatment. We'll never keep pace with our treatment efforts if we don't also at the same time mount as an effective response to prevent the spread of new HIV infections. We can't afford, nor should we allow, 5 million new infections to occur globally every year.
What's the profile of
in our own country as well?
Yeah, Dr. Gale, what's the profile of how those infections occur today? How much is sexual, gay sex, heterosexual sex? How much is drug use, needles, and the rest? What are the major paths? Where?
Well, the majority is sexual spread, and most of that is heterosexual, male-female, female-to-male spread. About over 80% worldwide of spread of HIV is heterosexual.
And in the U.S.?
In our country, it is still men who have sex with men who make up the largest single proportion of spread, but heterosexual transmission is increasing, and injection drug use continues to play a major role as well. So I think we need to both recognize that male-to-male sexual contact has a huge impact here in this country, but globally heterosexual contact makes up most of the spread of HIV.
Dr. Helen Gale, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to welcome into our conversation John Manuel Andriot. He's a journalist. He's reported on HIV/AIDS in the U.S. and the developing world since 1986, a long time. Contributor to the Washington Post, author of Victory Deferred, How AIDS Changed Gay Life in America. John Manuel Andriot, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You wrote very recently of your long-term coverage of AIDS and then the very recent news that after all that coverage, you yourself now are HIV positive. It kind of stands as a symbol for how this is all around us. We've learned so much about it, and yet it can still come and bite.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's true. I was pretty stunned when I learned at my routine annual checkup that I had tested positive after 18 years of testing negative.
You're homosexual, and so it came to you through that path. How do you look at the way the gay community and the greater national community have confronted this? Has it been bold? Has it been straightforward? Has it been thwarted? How do you see it?
Well, I think that from the beginning of the epidemic, the gay community mounted an incredibly valiant response to the epidemic in the face of terrific stigma and hatred and an utter lack of resources from the government. In the 80s especially, HIV/AIDS was looked at as a problem of the gay community for the community to address on its own and fund responses, treatment and prevention.
And today, still the stigma? Well, are we past that?
Well, there is still tremendous stigma, even within the gay community. There's a sense that many people have, especially outside of the major urban areas, that I don't know anyone with HIV. But the fact is that, as CDC reports regularly, the majority of people with HIV don't know their status because people, unfortunately, don't get tested on a regular basis.
And we read that something like 25% or 30% of new infections come through carriers who don't know they themselves have it. Dr. Gale, after 25 years, are we facing AIDS more squarely, or as it becomes isolated to some extent and more overseas, are we looking away?
Well, I think we are not facing AIDS as squarely here in this country as we should. As I mentioned earlier, I think in many ways the remarkable successes by having better treatments has lulled people into a sense of complacency about this epidemic. We still have many more new HIV infections occurring in this country than should be acceptable. And I think we have, in some ways, thought that treatment alone was an effective response. and have let down our guard as far as preventing the spread, the further spread of HIV.
John Manuel, you say that after all your work over so many years, you really didn't understand this disease until you found that you yourself had it. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, over the years, as I reported on the epidemic and interviewed many hundreds of people, I certainly had the experience of listening to them and sharing the really intimate and heartbreaking stories of their lives and their efforts to deal with HIV/AIDS. And I certainly lost many of my own friends. It was extremely painful and frightening to realize in the 80s and in the early 90s that perhaps I could have the very same thing that was killing my friends. But I felt that, I was taking precautions and was selective in my sexual behavior. Mm. And for many years, that seemed to work just fine. And then suddenly, I had the shock last October of getting a positive test result from my doctor. And I'm here to tell you that it's a very different experience looking out at the world through the eyes of one with HIV than it is trying to understand it secondhand.
You've taken yourself as a kind of case in point here and written very openly about this. How have you come to understand your own infection? I mean, if you, who are so steeped in all of the details of HIV and AIDS, if even you could still get it, what does that tell us about attitudes? Does it mean you let your guard down? Is there still a lack of understanding about how to prevent this? What's the lesson we take away at a public or a global level from one story here, yours?
Well, I think an important thing to understand is that even when we're talking about practicing low-risk sex, low risk still involves risk. And as one HIV-positive friend puts it, people actually do win the lottery. You know, we want to think that, or lose it. We want to think that the choices we make, the informed choices based on the best information that we have, will protect us. But unfortunately, HIV is a virus, a microbe, and all it takes is one time to invade our bodies, and unfortunately, we can't get rid of it once it's there.
Dr. Gale, on this front of sexuality, as you look out at it at a large public health level, but it still comes down to personal behavior, personal decisions, how do you see the behaviors that are still not well enough, understood, reined in, discussed? What's important for us to be talking about on the sexuality front here?
Well, you raise the very questions that make it imperative that we do talk openly and honestly about sexuality, and that we also recognize that changing behavior is more than just knowledge and information. There's a great deal of knowledge about how HIV is transmitted among the general population, but that doesn't necessarily make it easy for people to apply that knowledge. We know from looking at the changes in behavior in smoking over time that it took many decades to actually bring about a change in smoking behaviors. And this is a behavior that's much more public, that's much more easy to sanction. And so when we talk about something that's as ingrained as sexual behavior, that's so intertwined with so many other issues, you know, we really have to be open and honest and straightforward about what will it really take to change social norms, change behaviors, give people the support to be able to make a difference to make changes in their behavior around this very difficult to change behavior of sex and sexuality. So, you know, I think it's just not that simple. And people often, you know, one of the questions I get asked the most is, you know, well, why are people still doing this? We know what causes HIV. Can't you just hand people a leaflet? Can't you give information?
Mm-hmm.
Won't people change their behavior once they know? Well, yes and no. And I think the people for whom it was easiest to change behavior, who had the greatest incentives, who had the best, maybe most well-organized social situation, they might have been able to change behavior early on just based on information. But I don't think it's that easy, and I think that's where we underestimate that prevention is more than giving out information. It's more than handing out leaflets. It's actually helping people to get to a place where they can make long-term sustained behavior changes of a difficult nature.
John Manuel, do you think that the aura of fear has diminished as the survival rate with the new sort of cocktail of drug treatments has become so much higher than it ever was? Has it taken away that kind of penumbra of fear that had everybody, gay, straight, you name it, really in its grip if you go, let's say, 10 or 15 years back?
Well, I do think that it has changed the situation, and I've observed that within the gay community around the United States. As evidence, we could look at rising rates of other sexually transmitted infections in cities across the U.S., infections that are transmitted in precisely the same ways as HIV. There seems to be sort of a letting down our guard in general and a feeling that, well, if I become infected with HIV or anything else, there will be treatment available. But unfortunately, the treatment is extremely complicated and expensive and raises all sorts of potential side effects of its own.
The treatment, no fun to live with in itself. I want to invite our listeners in. A lot of them want to join Abebe's call in from Concord, New Hampshire. Abebe, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you very much. I came from Africa, and I lived in Ethiopia throughout my life until 1991 and went to college. But by then, I grew up with a communist regime. I don't know if you guys remember it. There was a big terror. They call it rare terror. People were dying, and
right.
It was bad. And by then, we were forced to learn political science, and they were telling us America is imperialist, and they are sending HIV through a small bat called the condom. Never wear it. You will get HIV and so on.
So you're growing up in Ethiopia being told not to wear a condom because it was an imperialist plot to infect you.
Yes. And we were thinking it's a political creature manufactured in the lab. And then when I went to college, I realized that it is not.
How do you see it today when 73% of HIV-infected folks are in sub-Saharan Africa? What should be done?
I think our government, even currently, has to work harder in order to prevent it than cure it. My brother has lost his life, and he took his own life once he noticed that he is HIV infected, because there's nobody who will care about you once you're infected. And he left two kids behind. But if the government had a very well-planned plan to protect people from HIV, it would be great. Now, the government, being from a tribe which is one-tenth of the population, protects only its tribe, not the rest of the Ethiopians. And the infection, as you see, has gone very far. I think democratic government and good structure that will distribute aid that come from countries such as United States would be great. Most of the people who are infected with HIV cannot get the necessary aid they get.
We see it, Abebe, and I want to put it to Dr. Helene Gale. We thank you for your call. Dr. Gale, now at the helm of CARE, you're looking very closely at the whole global picture here. President Bush has promised a lot of aid on this front, for Africa in particular. Abebe says, look, if you had democracy, we can work this out, but we've seen resistance to dealing with this in Africa. How do you look at Africa today? Is AIDS changing there because of the millions and millions of people who have it? Is it ultimately a factor for the whole planet, what happens with AIDS in Africa?
Well, I think we are in a more and more a global village. We are more interconnected today than ever before. And so what happens in Africa ultimately not only potentially foreshadows what could happen in other regions, but also does have an impact on the rest of our world. We're too connected for it not to. So I think we need to be concerned. I must applaud the Bush administration for the outpouring of support that has occurred through the president's initiative on AIDS.
Has that been delivered? He promised $15 billion in 2003.
Well, the increases have been pretty dramatic over the last couple of years, and there has been more resources available than ever before. Now, it's not enough. There's still a need for more global resources to fight HIV, and the United States clearly can't do it alone. So I think there's a lot to be said for the increases that have occurred. There's a lot more that needs to be done, and I think that There is clearly as much more that needs to be done, both on the prevention side as on the treatment side, where there's been so much focus over the last couple years. We can't continue to think that the response is only getting people treated and not realize that we also have to make sure that we continue a focus on prevention. And that includes the really important research that needs to continue and be accelerated, research to find a vaccine, which will ultimately have the greatest impact on slowing the spread of HIV. Research for things like microbicides, products that women can use, because women are now so heavily affected by this epidemic, and the current strategies are not as relevant to the needs of women around the world. So there's a lot that needs to be done. It needs to be a comprehensive and holistic approach, and we need to care about Africa. We need to care about the spread, the increasing spread in Asia, in Eastern Europe, but also not to lose our our eye off the ball here in the United States, because we still have 40,000 new infections occurring here, and the United States ought to be an example for the rest of the world about what it means to take this epidemic seriously and make sure that we put the resources and the right policies in place for both prevention as well as treating people who are already infected so we can continue to have an effective, a positive impact on slowing the rates of death due to HIV in this country.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. Of course, this issue of where to put the emphasis and how to go after AIDS has been widely debated and freighted with all kinds of emotion and ideology, religion, you name it. John Manuel Andriot, you write recently in the Washington Post about recalling your anger when President Bush put it in terms of values rather than in methods of prevention, about your anger when comprehensive sex education gets blocked. And yet, clearly, sex education, as you said earlier, and Dr. Gale as well, is not enough. Is there still a values issue, a values issue in this AIDS epidemic somehow?
Well, there is. And actually, I had been critical of President Reagan, not Bush.
I'm sorry, President Reagan, who, all the way back in that speech in 87, was it?
1987, mm-hmm. In his first speech on HIV/AIDS, called for values, you know, rather than giving people specific ways to prevent the transmission of HIV. To this day, prevention continues to be the really sticky wicket. No one can agree on what exactly we need to say in general. But as early as 1984, CDC sent researchers out to 9 U.S. cities to assess what was being done on prevention there, and their conclusion was that the prevention efforts in the gay community were really the best way to go about it. We needed targeted, explicit prevention that speaks in the language and culture of the audience that we're trying to reach.
But when we take that approach, I mean, look at your situation. You knew everything in the world there was to know about AIDS and HIV, and still you became infected. Does that point to some kind of values issue still sitting out there? We talked with Larry Kramer, the big AIDS activist, not long ago, and he was just furious about the way people somehow, even when fully educated, do not, cannot, you name it, take on board the severity. And said maybe there is a values element here, not the anti-gay agenda that was often linked to this in the first place, but something around values. What do you say to that?
Well, there certainly is. It comes down to personal choices. And healthy people make healthy choices. Unhealthy people don't tend to make healthy choices. I would say that in my case, I was a pretty healthy person with a fairly good sense of self-esteem. But at the same time, you know, I'm a human being. And I like anyone else, I'm subject to biological factors. And, you know, if my body encountered a virus and it was able to get in, it did. And that had little to do, as Dr. Gale pointed out, with my knowledge and intelligence on the subject.
Let's take a call from Don in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Don, you're on the air.
Hello. Here's a thought experiment. Get tested together for a variety of sexually transmitted infections, including human immunodeficiency virus, and share the results with your potential sex partner before having sex.
Of course, a lot of people have done that in the many years now since this came on the scene, haven't they, Don?
It's a phenomenon that's been going on unobserved by public health officials.
But maybe too much to ask for everybody to do that before every encounter. Helene Gayle, do you see people still going out and getting tested before sex, or is that something that now looks antique from the late 80s, early 90s?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of false security in that. First of all, there is a window period, a period where you're not making the antibody response that's detected by the test. And I think it also perhaps gets around the core issue, which is people should be thinking about how to reduce their risk overall, not playing Russian roulette by getting a test and then deciding whether or not to engage in risk behavior. So the real response is to have a strong, vigorous prevention and public health effort that really helps people to reduce their risk for the long term.
Helene Gayle, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
We're joined right now from Richmond, Virginia, by Pernessa Seal. She's founder of Balm in Gilead, an organization devoted to disseminating information about AIDS through black churches nationwide. Pernessa Seal, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Gayle already pointed it out, but the numbers are pretty shocking. Look back to 1998. African-American women constituted 64% of new female AIDS cases. African-American men accounted for 50% of new AIDS cases among men. And this in a population that's only about, 11 or 12% of the U.S. population, a heavy, heavy burden here on the black community. How are you addressing it?
Well, the Balm in Gilead, we believe that the fundamental place to start is the African-American faith community. It is where we organize our voice to speak out on issues. It is where we disseminate information. It is the, in my opinion, it is the ideal place. We must get churches and other faith communities involved, because when churches get involved, the stigma of HIV also goes down.
AIDS, the number one cause of death now for black adults aged 25 to 44, before heart disease, before cancer, before homicide. What's the reaction been, given those terrible numbers, to your effort here? Is there an openness to this? Is there still a resistance to talking about the sexual issues that come along with AIDS?
I think that there is still a resistance to talk about it. I think that over the past 25 years, we have certainly come a long way. No doubt about that. We've come a long way, but the resistance is still there. The misinformation is still there, and people still just don't know about HIV and AIDS in this country, as Dr. Gayle pointed out. Some of us, we really think that, the information is out there, but in many, many, many pockets in the United States, people just don't know about HIV.
Overall, have black churches been a good conduit, or are they still a bulwark of resistance to discussion of homosexuality, sexuality in general?
I think that many churches are coming around. They are. We can look at model churches today who have HIV services at their churches, who speak out affirmatively about people living with HIV, who are giving out information in their community. So I think that churches are definitely coming. Many churches are coming around to be a positive role model. But yet, we also must continue to work and continue to encourage churches who are still problematic.
Let's take a call from Marla in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Marla, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to add, and I'm glad you have a new guest on, that actually it was already in 1987, if you called out of the New York Times all the figures on the race dispersion around HIV infections among gay men, 50% were black men in 1987, and no public policy came into place to really move on that. And in fact, organizations, groups of young people of color started doing organizing, but they couldn't get the kind of funding necessary. And yes, there's resistance in various communities, but also there were like kind of sub rosa ways in which all these youth knew how to organize, had to reframe the issues, but the policies didn't really back them up. And I was just wondering, that the media, on the one hand, didn't carry the ball in identifying what was going on in terms of the race, and also the policies weren't there. And the values question, I was wondering if your guest could comment on that, because stigmas around homosexuality, et cetera, still prevent people from thinking about it. But it seems to me, from my own daughter's context, that kids are having unprotected sex
it should,
all over the place. And
yep.
You can say all you want, we don't want it. And I say that to my daughter. But it's happening, and the girls are getting pregnant, and they're college-bound girls, you know, et cetera. It's not a function of educational issues. They've taken classes on it, et cetera, but it's not really in the culture, or it's not really pointing to the subgroups of kids to say, look, here's what's going on.
And still not really taking it on board. Marla, thanks for your call. John Manuel, first to you. There's a very high rate among gay blacks here. How does it translate across racial lines within the gay community? How's the racial factor seen? How's it discussed?
Well, Marla was absolutely correct that even as early as 1982, more than one-fifth of the AIDS cases that had been diagnosed to that point were already among African-American gay and bisexual men. And we've had this notion in this country that gay equals white and injection drug user equals black or Hispanic. But in fact, those behaviors, the sexual or drug-using behaviors, cross racial lines. So when we talk about the rate of HIV in the African-American community, we have to break it down more precisely as to who exactly are we talking about and how is HIV being transmitted. When we talk about HIV among men who have sex with men, gay or bisexual men, we're still talking about a large percentage of them are African-American and Latino men.
Pernessa Seal, you were an immunologist at Harlem Hospital in the 80s. You saw this unfold right in front of your eyes. Why do you think the race piece was so slow to come into a full national conversation? Were people reluctant to hang this on one group or another? Was it cultural resistance from within the black community, or was it a lack of caring or a fear to name it without?
Well, you know, unfortunately, race is so in the fabric of how we address primarily anything in this country, and race certainly has played a role in how we have addressed health care in general, and HIV has just rolled into how we address HIV. You know, I agree with the sister whose comment that the epidemic has always been very, very strong in the African-American community, but the dollars, resources have never followed the epidemic. Public health science says that resources should follow the epidemic, and the resources with this government has never followed the epidemic in minority communities. Up until this day, it has never followed the epidemic. So I think that, you know, that's just the way it is here in America. Race always plays a factor. It is unthinkable that we have these kinds of numbers in this country, and there is no concrete plan to address HIV. But you know, there's no concrete national plan to address HIV/AIDS in this country among African Americans, gay, white men, or anybody else. We do not have a comprehensive plan to address HIV/AIDS in this country after 25 years. When we look at how we hold the fire to other countries in addressing HIV/AIDS, we do not hold the fire to our country when it comes to addressing HIV/AIDS.
And what about treatment when it comes to that point? I mean, we know the infection rates are bad. 60% of AIDS cases reported in 1999 among 13 to 19-year-olds among blacks. And again, you know, a terrible multiple of their actual representation demographically. What about the drug cocktails, the treatment? Once it's diagnosed, Pernessa Seal, how is that? Is it getting proportionally to the black population that's carrying so much of the weight of this disease?
No, it's not. You know, in this country, those who get access to the HIV treatment really primarily is where they live. If you live in New York, New York State has a wonderful ADAP program where you can get HIV treatment, medicine. If you live in Georgia, in Alabama, and Mississippi, and you are HIV positive, well, you don't quite get the drug. There's no drug treatment program down in most of the southern states. I can't speak of all the states. So, you know, access to treatment is a major problem in this country. And then what drugs do you get? Do you get the best cocktails, or do you get the ones that we're, you know, not as good as others? a lot of racism and classism, not just racism, but classism as well, plays into who gets treatment and how they get treated in this country.
Mm. Let me take a call from Beaufort, South Carolina. Ralph is on the line. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Yes. I would just like to encourage the values aspect of it, because I applaud the lady who is going to the churches. I think that is essential that we get the churches involved in values training. You know, Uganda, and I've forgotten now what it all stands for, but ABC, abstinence and condoms, they mm-hmm. really taught abstinence. Now, that helps. We've got to teach that, and I know not everybody's going to be abstinent, but we've got to teach it. And condoms doesn't prevent AIDS, and we need to, you know, debunk that one. It helps, but it doesn't prevent.
Mm.
And so that's part of where values training comes in, is understanding the limitations of condoms, but the absolute part of the abstinence. And is it possible for a person to be abstinent if they're facing a life-threatening disease? And if we teach it more about that, it might be.
Let us pick that up, Ralph. Pernessa, do you teach abstinence when you go into black churches?
Well, there are many churches who want to talk about abstinence, and yes, we support abstinence-based programs. And I think that they are very effective and very important. However, we have to also understand that the house is on fire. The African-American house is on fire, burning down, and probably the back porch is the only thing that's not on fire yet. So we must use everything. All prevention interventions must be used. For churches who want to be abstinence-based, I support them, provide training and technical assistance to them. And there are churches who also understand that our children are sexually active, and they want to save those children's lives, so therefore we must also talk about condoms. So, you know, just like we must talk about needle exchange programs. Everything is important now when you have these kinds of numbers, because every life is valuable.
Mm.
So abstinence is important. The A, the B, and the C is equally important when you have this kind of devastation of HIV, of a preventable disease in your community.
The numbers are scary right there. Robert's calling from Boston. Hi, Robert. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been HIV positive since 2003, and I just came across the fact that I was not aware of it up until just recently. I think the U.S. has taken their eye off the ball, as Dr. Gale was saying. We should be an example, and we're not. I'm embarrassed and ashamed that we're not. Brazil, as an example, has, even with their economic state and religious culture, has guaranteed treatment to everyone that is HIV positive. And I'm lucky that I live in Boston or in Massachusetts and have a very good health care system, and I'm not on a waiting list for treatment.
Mm-hmm.
But Massachusetts is one of a very small number of states that does not have a waiting list for assistance for drugs.
So we can talk about how effective the antiretroviral cocktails are, but if you can't get them, they don't work for you. Robert, let us pick that up. John Manuel Andriot, you faced that squarely when you found out you were HIV positive, what it was going to cost you per month and what your insurance would actually cover. How did you, how do others get past that?
Well, absolutely. Robert is right on the mark there. I had private health insurance and was shocked to discover that my insurance only paid up to $1,500 a year for prescriptions. And a simple phone call to the local pharmacy that provides HIV medications showed me that the two things that I would need to take each month for each day for the rest of my life would cost about $1,700 a month. So it's significant. And the way I addressed it is I was able to get into a clinical trial at DC's Whitman Walker Clinic, through which I'm able to get the medications I need for 96 weeks, not quite 2 years. So I have the clock ticking here, trying to figure out what I'm going to do after those 96 weeks are over.
What?
Most people don't even have that luxury. So again, it's wonderful that we have effective medications for those who have access to them, but most people in the world who need HIV medication do not have access to them.
And even here in the United States, Prenecil, 40,000 new HIV infections a year. What percentage of those people do get access to the cocktails that make such life extension possible?
I don't have that specific number, mm-hmm. but I would guess that, you know, back to the geographical location. If you are in the Northeast, I would say there's a higher percentage of HIV-infected people are on the cocktails. If you're in the South or in the Midwest, those numbers are decreased.
And, John, when you look ahead, how do you see where this epidemic is going? Does it eventually burn itself out, or does it, I mean, the numbers have only grown so far. So does it continue to grow? Do we get on top of it? Is it an open question? Does it come back to the United States in bigger numbers if it continues to rage abroad?
Well, it really continues to rage in this country as well. You know, we talk about the global AIDS pandemic, but we don't think about the fact that the United States situation is part of that global pandemic, that the issues and the pre-existing factors that make people vulnerable to HIV infection exist right here at home. You know, poverty and a lack of education, a lack of health care for people who are most at risk, especially in communities of color. So we're looking at a situation here where the drugs are able to keep people well and alive, which means that the number of people living with HIV is greater than ever before. But as long as people are living with HIV, they have the potential to transmit HIV as well. So that's important to remember. We keep people alive, but we're also kind of perpetuating the possibility of further transmission.
25 years from now, picture still unclear in that analysis. John Manuel Andriot, I want to thank you so much for being with us and wish you good luck with your HIV infection. Thanks a lot for sharing with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
John Manuel Andriot, a journalist who's covered HIV/AIDS for more than 20 years, now infected himself. His book is Victory Deferred. And Pernessa Seal, founder of Balm in Gilead, working through black churches to address AIDS nationwide. Ms. Seal, thank you very much for joining us this hour.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation, download the On Point podcast, or subscribe to our daily newsletter, all at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.